is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Tehran criticizes London for supporting a Saudi-funded television channel that propagates terror and violence in Iran. Two more Palestinians are added to the victims of Israel's deadly violence in the occupied West Bank. Scotland's First Minister says the UK is threatening democracy by rejecting an independence referendum plan. Top story. Tehran has strongly condemned the UK's support for a London-based Saudi-funded anti-Iran TV channel. The Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the British Foreign Secretary's claim to taking, quote, the importance of free, honest and open journalism incredibly seriously was just an empty allegation. He added that the channel supported by James Cleverly is freely propagating terror and violence against the Iranian nation and its national security. Kanani reminded Cleverly that his backing for the Saudi-funded Iran International Channel amounts to supporting the anti-Iran war room. Iran's intelligence ministry has designated Iran International Channel as a terrorist organization over its role in stoking the recent violence and riots in the country. Tehran University Professor Said Mohammad Mirandi says the West-based Persian language media would have been immediately shut down if they were addressing the English-speaking audience as they support the spread of violence.
There's no doubt that the Americans and the Europeans are deeply involved in these very violent riots, and we know they're violent because well over 40 police officers and Basij members were murdered by these different rioters. And the United States and the Europeans, if this had happened in their own countries, they wouldn't tolerate any of this. But these rioters are being egged on by Persian language media based in the West, largely in London, funded by the West and the Saudis. And these media outlets are calling the killings and the burnings and the beatings as legitimate. So Ofcom, if this was an these were English language media directed towards English speaking countries, they would shut these television stations down immediately and arrest these people. But when it comes to Iran, it's all fair game.
Tehran says reaching an agreement regarding the revival of the 2015 Iran deal is high on the agenda. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian stresses that the Islamic Republic is insisting on its red lines, saying that a deal is quite feasible if Tehran's demands are met. Kisumi Shahmadi has more.
Deal or no deal? While the EU is still reluctant to lay its negotiating cards on the table, at a press conference in the capital, Tehran, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian stressed that Iran's negotiating team is ready for the next round of talks and is waiting for the bloc's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, to set a date for ministerial-level negotiations.
We have made our stance clear, and in the previous negotiations, we communicated our views regarding the remaining issues. Last week, we announced that we are ready for the next round of talks, and now Mr. Borrell is following up and trying to set a date. Obviously, talk will continue if we make sure that our logical demands are met.
In the words of Hossein Amir Abdullahian, resolving the remaining issues with the IAEA, receiving guarantees on the economic benefits of the deal for Iran, and removing unilateral sanctions are the three key issues that need to be worked out.
The JCPOA revival talks are high on the agenda, and we are adamantly following up on the issue. Of course, this will happen when we make sure that our reasonable demands in line with our national interests are met.
According to the top diplomat, Iran and the U.S. continue to exchange messages. However, American officials take what Amir Abdullahian calls a hypocritical stance while talking to mainstream media by making comments that contradict the messages that they send to Iran.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has always deviated from its technical path and taken a political stance. European and American negotiators had promised that this would not happen again, but they broke their promise yet another time.
These comments come after a recent anti-Iran resolution passed by the IAEA Board of Governors prompted the Islamic Republic to announce that it will begin 60% uranium enrichment in its Fordow nuclear facility. Over the past couple of years, Iran has demonstrated in practice that it is committed to the JCPOA, or the nuclear deal. It has always been the other side that has neglected the agreement. Now, Iran says for these negotiations to reach a final conclusion, it is necessary for the other side to offer some guarantees that it will remain committed to any agreement that is reached. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Turning elsewhere now, Israeli forces have killed two more Palestinian youths as the regime's atrocities continue unabated across the occupied Palestinian territories. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 22-year-old Mohammed Hisham Mohammed Abu Khoshk succumbed to injuries he sustained after being shot in the abdomen by Israeli forces during a raid in the city of Nablus. Meanwhile, Mohammed Ahmed Hassan Harizadeh, aged 30, also succumbed to severe head injuries he sustained about 4 months ago in July. Harizadeh was a former prisoner who had been arrested by the regime's forces in late 2013 and spent a year and a half in jail. The new fatalities increased the total number of Palestinians killed since the beginning of this year to 202. The figure includes 150 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and 52 in the besieged Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, Israel has approved the construction of hundreds of new settler units in the occupied West Bank, defying international outcry over the measure. According to Palestinian media, the regime is to seize 120 hectares of land in Wadi Rahal village south of the city of Bethlehem. The plan also includes the construction of 7,000 more settler units in Bethlehem in its next phase. Israel's Supreme Court has turned down an appeal by Palestinians to prevent the settlement expansion plan. Thousands of Israeli settlers squat in settlements built since 1967, when Israel occupied the West Bank and Al-Quds. all Israeli settlements are considered illegal under international law. The UN has time and again condemned Israel's settlement expansion policy, calling on the regime to stop such activities. Moving on, North Korea is reacting angrily to a push by its southern neighbor for additional sanctions on Pyongyang over its missile launches in recent weeks. North Korean leader's sister, Kim Yo-jong, has described the South Korean president and his administration, using her own words, as idiots who are parroting the United States. She's even compared the government in Seoul to a faithful dog, which is owned by Washington. Kim also warned that additional sanctions and pressure would only add to the North's hostility and anger. Meanwhile, the South has called those comments deplorable. Seoul this week announced it was considering fresh unilateral sanctions on the North over its recent missile tests, including an intercontinental ballistic one last week, but the North keeps insisting that the weapons tests are a response to provocations by Seoul and Washington, particularly their massive military drills which destabilize the peninsula. And in other news, Scotland's bid for independence from the United Kingdom has hit a roadblock following a ruling by Britain's apex court. The Supreme Court has said the Scottish government does not reserve the right to hold a second referendum on whether to break from the UK without permission from London. The British Prime Minister has welcomed the court's decision, describing it as clear and definitive. But Scotland's First Minister has strongly criticised the move, saying democracy is being threatened.
In the meantime, the SNP will launch and mobilise a major campaign in defence of Scottish democracy. For we should be in no doubt, as of today, democracy is what is at stake. This is no longer just about whether or not Scotland becomes independent, vital though that decision is. It is now more fundamental. It is now about whether or not we even have the basic democratic right to choose our own future.
Sturgeon said that Britain's next general election would be a de facto vote on Scotland's secession. The first referendum on Scottish independence from the UK was held in 2014, but the move failed as only over 44% of the voters then at the time said yes to independence. Sturgeon and her pro-independence party say there's now a, quote, indisputable mandate for another plebiscite, considering the UK's exit from the European Union. Supporters of Scottish independence have hit the streets of Edinburgh to express their anger after the UK's top court blocked a second referendum in Scotland.
This is a shameful decision by the Lord Lords, and it will only strengthen the yes vote. Independence is now inevitable. They might try and stop it, but it's now a one-way path to independence.
But we're not surprised, but we still was that wee bit of hope that people would see sense here and let us have real say. Nobody's letting us have real say. Well, England are not letting us have our say. And I feel we're entitled to have our say. And that's just the way I feel right now. And I'm angry and I'm disappointed. That's about the size of it.
A bit devastated, but it's just the beginning. It is coming. We are having independence either in my lifetime or the kids' lifetimes. It's coming.
Yeah, the best decision, I think, for us is no, because the world, it'll get our goats up. It will, we are thrown. We do not like being told what to do. So if somebody tells us what to do, that makes us stand back and say, hoi, hold on a minute, you know, and that will give it the impetus that we need now, you know, being told, no, you cannot have it.
Activist and commentator Mick Napier says Scottish people have the right to decide whether or not they want to secede from the United Kingdom.
I don't think that this decision in London by the judges will have a positive effect as far as London's concerned, because it brings together two different things. One, the percentage, the proportion of Scottish people who want independence, and a very large number really want that independence passionately. The numbers of those who are prepared to vote for independence seems to be pretty strong as well. But now we throw into the mix not whether you're for independence, but whether Scots have a right to decide themselves on independence. And I think this is Sturgeon's strategy, is to raise that issue of democratic rights. Opinion polls in Scotland were showing that trust in the London government was vanishingly small. It was below 20% of people who thought that they could trust the London government. And whether deservedly or not, those who are prepared to trust the Holyrood Parliament in Edinburgh was in the very high 70s, almost 80%. So the problem's not going to go away.
Moving on, Ukraine is pressing the UN Security Council to take action against Russia's airstrikes, which it says have devastated its infrastructure in recent weeks.
We are awaiting a very firm reaction of the world to today's Russian terror, response of our partners, response of our friends, not just observers, but a reaction from all those who really recognize the UN Charter. We're doing everything possible. Ukraine represented a peace formula. The world heard it, 10 items in order to empower the Charter of UN and violated by Russian guarantee security for Ukraine, Europe, and all the peoples of this planet suffering from the consequences of the Russian aggression.
Addressing an urgent meeting of the UN Security Council, Zelensky claimed that in the past 24 hours alone, Russia has fired more than 70 missiles at Ukraine. He said that the airstrikes have affected houses, schools, hospitals, and transportation systems. Moldova's permanent representative to the UN also condemned Russia's attacks on Ukraine, saying the strikes have taken a toll on his country as well. He said more than half of Moldova was left without electricity last week, with some areas still experiencing power outages. Also speaking at the same session was Russia's envoy, who offered Moscow's narrative of the events.
The damage to residential housing and victims among the peaceful population is indeed caused by the Ukrainian air defense systems, which are not located at the outskirts of the cities, but in the very center. As a result, the missiles, those that hit those places which Russia never targeted. So, for example, today, users posted photos on the internet of missiles that hit residential homes in Kiev. Turns out that these were American air defense missiles, which were supplied to Kiev.
The Russian envoy also criticized Kiev and its Western supporters for their threats and ultimatums. Moscow denies carrying out attacks on non-military targets. It has also condemned the West for covering up the crimes of the Ukrainian military in pro-Russia areas. That brings an end to World Bulletin for this hour.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Basij, Islamic Revolution's Fruitful Tree. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. One of the obvious characteristics of Imam Khomeini was his foresightedness and acumen. He would make decisions whose accuracy and importance would be known later on. For instance, less than 10 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, he thought that in order to safeguard the revolution and the country, it was necessary to have an organized and trained body. Thus, the Imam issued the order of establishment of such an organization on November 26, 1979, which came to be known later on as Basij Mostaz'afin, meaning Volunteers of the Oppressed. Then, 10 months after this order, the Iraqi dictator Saddam, at the behest of his masters in Washington and Moscow, initiated an all-out aggression against Iran and the Islamic Revolution to overthrow the Islamic Republic system. In those days, the unique and fateful role of the Basij forces was revealed to all. Imam Khomeini said, "If we want to present a perfect manifestation of self-sacrifice, sincerity and love of God and Islam, who will deserve more than Basij and Basijis?" The Basij Commemoration Week in Iran marks the countless selfless efforts of Basij Mobilization Force, which have been carried out for the elevation and honor of Iran. Stay with us for an exclusive feature on this occasion. The outstanding characteristics of Basij forces caused Imam Khomeini and Ayatollah Khamenei to praise them and use lofty words and phrases to describe them, perhaps the loftiest phrase that the two leaders of the Islamic Revolution have used is Shajaraye Tayyebe, meaning pure and sweet-smelling tree. This has been adopted from Ayahs 24 and 25 of Surah Ibrahim of the Noble Quran. There, God likens pure word to a pure tree whose roots are fixed in the earth while its branches are in the sky, yielding fruit whenever God permits. Ayatollah Khamenei describes Basij forces with reference to these ayahs. You, Basijis, are the sweetest smelling and pure fruits of that tree which the great Imam planted. This fruitfulness will continue, just as God says. Have you now seen how God gave a parable of a pure word, resembling a pure tree, whose root is firm and whose branches in the heaven, yielding its fruit every time by the permission of its Lord? When the field is favorable and ready and the seed is pure, that plant is not terminable. I mean that no factor can harm it. Basij is such a sweet-smelling and pure tree. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, the sapling of Basij, which had been planted by Imam Khomeini absolutely for God's satisfaction, has turned into a strong and sturdy tree with firm roots and ample branches that bears new fruits on different occasions. Basij has proved its unending potentials for solving intricate problems and removing various obstacles in every domain. This lofty status of Basij is originated in the divine virtues such as spirituality, sincerity, popularity, insight, religious awareness, submission to the leader, purity, humbleness, simplicity, inexhaustibility, and constant preparedness for every job. Basij has turned into a role model for other freedom-seeking nations. Today, Lebanon, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, occupied Palestine, Nigeria, and other places have learned the model of Basij in their fight against oppressive and colonialist regimes and elements. Principally, any person or group that works with pure intention for the sake of serving the poor and downtrodden masses, God will exalt it in the eyes of people. The characteristics of Basij were manifested during the 8-year holy defense in the best way. These characteristics continued after the end of the war in the form of helping the poor, assisting those hurt in different events, safeguarding the security of country and health programs such as nationwide vaccination, etc. Currently, since the outbreak of coronavirus in the country, Basij forces have participated in a variety of activities to hamper the spread of the deadly disease and aid the low-income classes who have lost their job. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "Wherever there is a struggle, there is Basij. Struggle in the field of knowledge, struggle in the field of politics, struggle in the field of social activities, struggle in the vast field and great international arena. These struggles continue and will continue." Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader enumerates the features of this jihadi spirit, saying, "Work for God and as a duty, not forgetting the ideals, using all forces and capacities, relentless, inexhaustible, and enthusiastic effort, trust in the youth, and belief in the principle of we can." Dear listeners, the important point about Basij is to preserve and bolster valuable divine characteristics. Ayatollah Khamenei keeps stressing a strengthening of moral virtues to all youths, especially Basiji youths. He reiterates to them to work without expecting any reward or even encouragement. Like Imam Khomeini, he highlights the principle that a member of Basij should work only for God. Insight is another characteristic of Basij. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "Dear youth, dear Basijis, wherever that you are in the country, increase this insight day by day. Do not let some material needs and paltry issues prevent insight. Protect your insight and know your enemy. The enemy has various stratagems, and that nation will be successful which is not deceived." On the importance of acquiring modern sciences and technologies for Basijis, Ayatollah Khamenei says, "Basij should enter the arena of knowledge ahead of all. You should go and capture the unknown scientific vistas, technological vistas, and innovative vistas." In other words, he believes that Basij should be equipped with two tools of knowledge and faith in order to be helpful in diverse spheres of services to the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Ummah. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, said, "I always envy of the sincerity and purity of Basijis and appeal to God to resurrect me with Basijis, as in this world I am honored to be a Basiji."
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Designing the bomb.
Part 1.
In the beginning, God created light. Based on the old Torah scrolls, Jewish rabbis believe that light was God's first creation. In the 20th century, physicists doubted the nature of light. Was light small particles moving in space, or was it like sea waves? According to Jewish rabbis, water was the second element created by God. Water, with its wave motion, was the first Jewish embodiment of matter. In Jewish mythology, creation was God's will to transform energy into matter. At the beginning of the 20th century, a Jewish scientist from Europe established the equation as his theoretical foundation in physics, a theory in which matter and energy were interchangeable with one another. Albert Einstein, like many other Jewish scientists, immigrated to America with the spread of Nazism and its threat against Jews. At the same time, research into a backlash had begun. This time, instead of the movement of energy to matter, the movement of matter to energy was investigated. This reverse move had the opposite result. If the movement of energy into matter led to creation, the movement of matter into energy had a high power of destruction. By the way, most of the scientists who noticed this destructive power in America were scientists from the Jewish background. Scientists like Eugene Wigner, Leo Szilard, and Edward Teller. These scientists had migrated from Eastern Europe. They decided to inform the American authorities about the heinous power after feeling the danger that the German Nazis were about to discover the secret of the reverse movement of creation. They wrote to Albert Einstein and asked him to write a letter to the President of the United States. In that letter, he mentioned the destructive power of a newly discovered energy and informed that the Nazis were making a devastating bomb based on this energy. This letter attracted the attention of then President of the United States, Franklin D. Roosevelt. At that time, only 2 months had passed since the start of World War II, and the United States had still remained neutral. On October 21, 1939, a meeting of the Special Committee to investigate this issue was held with the presence of Jewish scholars, Eugene Wigner, Leo Szilard, and Edward Teller. The result of this meeting was that uranium can be the source of production of bombs that were more destructive than any other material ever experienced in the world. They proposed a budget of $167,000 for uranium research. They mainly studied uranium-235 isotope and a new substance called plutonium. The Americans chose a Jewish physicist from the University of California to lead the bomb production project, J. Robert Oppenheimer. He held various meetings in U.S. universities with many physicists to investigate possibilities and solutions. The American government informed the research group that it would provide them with any kind of financial, human, and logistical assistance. Oppenheimer was a Jew, but he was very interested in Indian mythology. One of the myths was Mahabharata, the national epic of Indians. A part of this epic was called Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu, the Hindu god, wore war clothes and became the destroyer of the worlds. J. Robert Oppenheimer was designing the most destructive weapon in history, and he saw this myth as his source of inspiration. The destroyer of worlds was an inverse reflection of the Jewish creation myth, the return of matter to energy, and the subsequent destruction of the world. On December 18, 1941, Japanese fighter jets attack Pearl Harbor. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Following the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor, the United States declared war on Japan and Germany. U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt called his country arsenal of democracy and aroused the emotions of members of Congress with a sensational speech.
Since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
Franklin D. Roosevelt knew that war was America's first priority from then on. The Japanese were fierce warriors, so the Manhattan Project had already become important for the U.S. At the same time, hatred against Japanese and Germans was being propagated all over America. The U.S. propaganda machine also used Walt Disney animation. The U.S. had entered into chaos. The intense propaganda of the American government for enlistment began. American soldiers went to war in the Pacific Ocean. Some soldiers went to Europe. Humanity experienced the most terrible war until that time, a kind of war that was a direct product of modern times. The Japanese also had a myth similar to the Jews for the creation of the world. In the oldest Japanese legends, the world before creation was nothing but formless matter. Something called chaos. The silence reigned in the time of turmoil and disorder. Suddenly, the sound arose and particles began to move. The movement of particles created light. Thus, light was placed at the highest place in the world, and below it were particles that first created clouds and then heaven. The Japanese concept of light and then cloud had a strange similarity with the Jewish concept of light and then water. The movement of particles in Japanese mythology led to the creation of light energy. The cloud was formed, and under that was heaven. In the modern era, this myth took on a frightening and twisted description. Far from the two fronts of Europe and the Pacific Ocean, the nuclear scientists of America, England, and Canada continued their research in silence. Oak Ridge in Tennessee was the first proposed area for research. The government forcibly seized 56,000 acres of land in this area worth $3.5 million to carry out its research. Later, another 3,000 acres were added to the area. 1,000 families had lost their land under the influence of the government's behavior. Complaints and legal procedures of these citizens against the government did not reach any conclusion, though. Finally, people complained to their Congress representatives, but the Congress investigation could not challenge the government's decision. Some of these families had lived in these properties for generations, but they had to vacate their land within 2 weeks, according to the military order. The army did not pay the families more than $47 per acre. The villagers had no choice but to sell their land. Oak Ridge nuclear research was mostly theoretical from then on. It seemed the Jewish immigration scientists and Americans still had a long way to go to the practical stage of nuclear fission. But finally, in 1943, the research entered the phase of practical experiments. For several months, the Army and scientists were looking for a suitable place to carry out the experiments. J. Robert Oppenheimer owned a large land in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He suggested conducting the experiments in that area. Jemez Springs in New Mexico was another alternative. But this area was surrounded by Rocky Mountains. Oppenheimer did not like the area and said that in order for the employees not to be afraid, it was better to find a wide and flat area. Finally, Los Alamos was chosen. Oppenheimer went to Los Alamos and was impressed by the beauty of nature. Since then, the beautiful area was a secret laboratory of American nuclear bombs. With the continuous activity of uranium enrichment centers, the United States was finally able to obtain 50 kilograms of uranium-235 with a purity of 89% by July 1945. Nuclear scientists entered a new stage, designing the bomb. At the same time, the war continued. Little by little, the Allies' success became evident. The Americans, with the support of the British, entered the mainland of Europe in the invasion of Normandy and the north of France. On August 25, 1944, Paris was liberated. In Europe, the war was in the favor of the Allies. In Asia, Japan surrounded the Assam region of India, but finally retreated. In the Pacific, America was able to defeat the Japanese forces in the Palau Islands. The naval battles between America and Japan in the Pacific Ocean ended one after another in favor of the Americans. Far from these battles, in the seemingly calm but quiet deserts of Los Alamos, nuclear scientists had come to the conclusion that they had to conduct an experiment and detonate the first bomb for test. Before carrying out that experiment, Germany was captured in April 1945. The war in Europe was over, but Japan was still resisting in Asia. Managers wanted only a controlled fission of plutonium, but Oppenheimer insisted that a full-blown nuclear explosion was required. Its code name was Trinity. Trinity means Jesus, God the Father, and the Holy Spirit. It was a central core of Christian beliefs. But did the Jewish scholars of the Manhattan Project mean a Christian Trinity? J. Robert Oppenheimer, in a letter to General Groves, mentioned a poem by Richard Slater Dunn, which started like this: "Batter my heart, three-personed God." Apparently, Oppenheimer did not intend to specify the reason for this naming. However, he may have referred to the three Hindu gods in addition to the Christian Trinity. One of the three gods was the destroyer Shiva, and the other was Vishnu, that was the destroyer of the worlds in the old epics. The third god was a creator god, or Brahma, similar to Jewish creation myths. But in front of him were gods with destructive forces. Scientists bet on the Trinity test. Some predicted that the bomb would not work. Some predicted its strength up to 45 tons of TNT. Another Jewish physicist, Isidore Isaac Rabi, predicted that the bomb would have the power of 18,000 tons of TNT. He was almost right. Isidore Isaac Rabi won that bet.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
The first atomic bomb was tested at 5:29 and 45 seconds a.m. Mountain War Time on July 16, 1945. The explosion almost equaled 20,000 tons of TNT. A pit with a diameter of 340 meters and a depth of 3 meters was made at the place of the explosion. Observers who were at least 16 kilometers away from the epicenter reported the high heat during the blast. The surrounding mountains seemed brighter than usual for a few seconds. The sky looked purple, which gradually changed to green and finally turned white. 40 seconds after the explosion, they suddenly heard its sound. The blast waves shook up to a radius of 160 kilometers. Kenneth Bainbridge, one of the test directors, remarked to J. Robert Oppenheimer immediately after the test, "Now we are all sons of bitches." Oppenheimer later said that at the moment of seeing the first nuclear explosion, he was thinking of a passage from the mystical book of Hindu religion. In a part of the book, the Hindu god says, "I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." At that time, Harry Truman had become president of the United States and was at Potsdam Conference. Potsdam was located in occupied Germany. Joseph Stalin, Winston Churchill, and Harry S. Truman attended the conference. The conference was held to clarify the situation of post-war Europe and defeated Germany.
"Our demand has been, and it remains, unconditional surrender. I want the entire world to know that this direction must and will remain unchanged and unhampered."
On the other hand, participants in the conference were waiting for the outcome of the war in the Pacific Ocean and Asia, Japan. Harry S. Truman received a coded telegram at Potsdam at 7:30 p.m. on July 16th. "Operated on this morning. Diagnosis not yet complete, but results seem satisfactory and already exceed expectations." Harry S. Truman informed Stalin that America had achieved a new and powerful weapon. On July 26, 1945, the Allies issued and announced an ultimatum which outlined the terms of surrender for the Empire of Japan. The ultimatum stated that if Japan did not surrender, it would face prompt and utter destruction, but this statement did not talk about the new bomb.
"Substantial portions of Japan's key industrial centers have been leveled to the ground in a series of record incendiary raids. What has already happened to Tokyo will happen to every Japanese city whose industries feed the Japanese war machine. If the Japanese insist on continuing resistance beyond the point of reason, their country will suffer the same destruction as Germany. Our blows will destroy their whole modern industrial plant and organization, which they have built up during the past century and which they are now devoting to a hopeless cause. We have no desire or intention to destroy or enslave the Japanese people. But only surrender can prevent the kind of ruin which they have seen come to Germany as a result of continued useless resistance."
In the first days of August 1945, the United States announced the names of several cities as targets of airstrikes by spreading leaflets over Japanese cities. The Japanese people thought that they were just bombings of conventional weapons, and news of the invention of the nuclear bomb had not yet spread. The United States did not mention Hiroshima among the cities it warned, while Hiroshima was the first target of the Americans for nuclear bombing.
The Americans chose to bomb the little boy for Hiroshima.
In the limelight.
Grand declarations at COP27 on tackling the climate emergency are sabotaged by a treaty from the 1990s that sees European nations held to ransom by the energy companies. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, in June, members of the European Parliament urged the European Commission, the nearest Europe has to a government, to ditch the energy treaty so that member states could make changes to their energy policies in line with their commitments under the Paris Agreement. Last month, the UN warned that even assuming industrialized nations stick to their pledges to cut emissions, the world is heading towards a 2.5 degrees Celsius rise in temperatures and catastrophic climate breakdown. But cutting and running would still leave EU members open to legal actions for losses over the next two decades. The European Commission has instead proposed reforms that will be discussed at an Energy Charter Treaty conference due to be held later this month in Mongolia. The amendments to the treaty are designed to placate countries like Germany that have been growing increasingly restless over the treaty. The proposal would allow EU member states to exclude any new fossil fuel investments from the treaty. They would also be able to shorten their liability for existing investments to 10 years or, at the latest, 2040. Climate activists have warned that the EU process is far too little, too late. Amendments to the treaty require unanimity and have previously taken years to complete. An activist also warned that Brussels' plans, even if it is eventually agreed, would allow investors to set up headquarters in other jurisdictions, such as the UK and Switzerland, where they could launch new settlement claims. Cornelia Marfield from Climate Action Network Europe Group told Energy Monitor this month, it is unbelievable the EU agreed to lock in fossil protection for at least another decade. This means countries will continue to spend taxpayers' money in compensating fossil fuel companies rather than fighting climate change and moving to a renewable energy system. She also warned that the reform would still leave Europe and other contracting parties exposed to compensation suits over polluting non-fossil fuel energy sources, such as hydrogen and biomass. Climate action groups have demanded a coordinated mass walkout from the treaty, effectively nullifying it, though there seems to be little appetite for it among European leaders. The problems with European energy policy have been thrown into stark relief, too, by the current crisis in Eastern Europe that has sent energy prices alongside energy industry profits soaring. It has also seen Europe scrambling for new sources of energy, including shipments by the US of a glut of liquefied natural gas, LNG, resulting from increased fracking. Such shipments have more than doubled over the past year. A new report by 50 watchdog groups notes that fossil fuel companies have been happy to take advantage of the chaos in the global energy market from the war, channeling their profits into fracking and new infrastructure to export liquefied natural gas. Reversing course on this fossil fuel bonanza would most likely result in yet more damages claims under the energy treaty in years to come. The Secretary General of the Energy Charter Treaty has cited the Ukraine crisis as a reason why EU members should not quit the pact, arguing that such a move would add to Europe's energy insecurity by antagonizing alternative supplies to Russia, such as Azerbaijan. But in reality, the treaty is deeply bound up with the origins of the crisis and its continuing geopolitical reverberations, all of them disastrous for the environment. Through the 2000s, the treaty provided the background to an energy crisis between Russia and Ukraine as the economies of both continued to struggle in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union. Moscow was incensed by Kiev's failure to pay its debts on gas supplies and also accused it of stealing gas in transit to Europe, Russia's biggest customer. In response, Russia twice shut down supplies through its Ukrainian grid, the second time in early 2009, depriving Europe of gas too. The cutoff came during one of Europe's coldest winters. Investors in Russia's gas giant Gazprom and Ukraine's national utility Naftogaz spent years battling out various disputes in arbitration courts. It was the failure of the treaty to resolve these that led Moscow to pull out in 2009. These tensions exacerbated, too, the split between Ukrainian politicians that looked to Moscow for security.